You are listening to the GeoNiagara Radio Show, sponsored by the Department of Geography and Tourism Studies at Brock University.
Welcome to Season 2, Episode 6 of the GeoNiagara Radio Show. I'm Darren.
And I'm RJ.
So I heard you traveled to Quebec recently for some form of a conference?
It wasn't a conference. It was known as GeoGames. And GeoGames are held once a year, typically by an Earth Science Department at a university. And it's basically a friendly competition between Earth Science Departments across Canada. And they get to compete with each other. And Earth Science is very popular among the French-speaking universities. So it was really interesting to see the language barrier between the English schools and the French schools and the competitions that had to be changed and done in two languages at the same time, such as trivia in English and French or improv in English and French. And Brock ended up coming in second place in the improv and having to go against the top team of the French, against the top team of the English, which is us. And it was quite the riot to see both French and English being spoken at the same time. I'm sure the audience was just loving that.
So is this like a kind of a Jeopardy type of thing with the trivia side of stuff? Or
so it was like an all-day Saturday event. We drove 13 hours to get from St. Catharines to Chicoutimi, Quebec, and which was about 3 hours north of Quebec City. And for all day Saturday, they had events going all day. So some of the first events of the day were trivia. And then they would send up two players from each team to do the trivia. And then next off, we did exams, actually. They had us write full exams that you would get judged and marked for. And all of these events would go towards a total score by the end of the game. So eventually we moved into the later events at the end of the night, such as a scavenger hunt in the snow. And the improv, and finally we ended with a giant talent show where we did an original song done by one of our TAs and a dance that went along with it that was about structural geology, which was extremely relevant. Yeah, it was pretty impressive. I think they were all quite impressed with our original song that was so relevant.
So things you would never think a song would be written about.
Exactly. So we had this amazing opportunity to use some original artwork that is native to our school, and we actually won the talent show because of that. They were really impressed with us.
Awesome. On Saturday, I took part in a neighborhood coffee pour over.
Excellent.
So,
what does that mean?
So, in the neighborhood that I live in, it's called basically the Fitzgerald neighborhood. We just call it the Fitz. And we're a neighborhood group that wants to work on beautification projects, community gardens, that sort of thing. And we also have a neighborhood team for one of the fundraisers for, it's called The Coldest Night of the Year, and it's a fundraiser for Start Me Up Niagara. And so what we decided to do was get together with all of our neighbors and do this coffee pour over, and we had some coffee donated from a roaster in Port Dalhousie, and we just set up a tent, boiled some water, and we have a neat little contraption that you put the coffee filters in and you just pour the hot water or boiling water over top of them. And it was a great way to meet our neighbors, basically discuss what we wanted to do in the summertime. So I think the whole coffee, I mean, it's not something that you see done all the time. And I've met neighbors that I've never met before, which is a really cool thing because I think a lot of us just go about our busy days and we don't necessarily pay attention. We might know our immediate neighbors to the left and right of us, but not so much a couple doors down or at the end of the road type of thing. So it was fun. So all the money that we raised is going to The Coldest Night of the Year, and that event is happening on Saturday, February the 24th.
Amazing. What a great opportunity. Now we're going to move on with the rest of our show, and this show is a little unique. It's going to be our master's student special. So we have three master's students here to talk with us today, and we're super excited to introduce them all. First up, we have Brent Thorne from the Earth Science Department at Brock University on the thesis topic of evaluating hydrologic conditions in an Arctic permafrost landscape. Brent also has an opportunity to raise some funding for himself. Brent recently released a video on YouTube of his research up at Old Crow Flats. For your interest, it'll be in the show notes, and every view goes towards helping him get NSERC funding, and the top view gets the most funding. So be sure to take a look at that at the end of the show.
Yeah, you know, we'll put a link directly into the onto our Facebook page for that, as well as put it in the show notes.
All right, and I'd like to introduce Brent Thorne.
Joining us on the show today is Brent Thorne, and Brent is a master's candidate in the Earth Science Department at Brock University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
One of the first questions that we always ask guests on the show is, could you give us some background on your journey to the master's program, specifically in the Earth Science Department?
Okay. Bit of a long one, but I'll try and keep it short. I originally started at Brock in the sport management program. And after a few years, I kind of felt that it wasn't necessarily the program for me. So I switched into general Bachelor of Science. And that's where I found physical geography, which led me down a road to a undergraduate thesis where I got to research Arctic science. And that has eventually led to me ending up in the Earth Science Department at Brock.
So I'd normally ask, were you always interested in geography? But you've already answered that question in a roundabout sort of way.
I think, honestly, I always have been. And I think that there was a large part of my success throughout even elementary school and high school that came from my natural tendencies towards kind of geography-based thinking and applications. And I think during university, I kind of came to realize that that's where my strong suits were.
So is there anybody that's, or anyone in particular, or a collective of people who have inspired you on your journey through the master's program?
Definitely. I would say there's quite a few professors in geography department at Brock who really challenged me and allowed me to kind of explore my strengths. That included Marilyn Jolyneau, Kevin Turner, Mike Pisarek, and Daryl, as well as, I would just say, the entire faculty has just been a great resource for me throughout my undergraduate career.
So moving on to your research, can you tell us about what you're doing? And so what is it all about?
Right. So the golden question. Yeah. What I'm researching is I want to understand why changes are happening in Arctic regions at a faster rate than other regions in the world, with longer warming seasons in the Arctic than in previous decades. There's been a lot of change to freshwater lake systems, and I want to understand how the land cover around a lake is impacting that change.
Are there specific outcomes that you hope this research will lead to, or is it just broader context of other parts of the puzzle?
I think that in general, any major research that happens is always just another piece of the puzzle. But I do think that the research that myself and Dr. Kevin Turner, my supervisor, are conducting will provide a key insight to how lakes are responding to this elongated warming period.
So when you're out in the field, there's obviously a field season that you go out and you collect your data. Can you walk us through a typical day of data collection?
Yeah, the first bit is preparation. It's a long time of prepping all of your equipment and all of the logistics just to even to get out there, because we're studying up in a place called Old Crow Flats, which is in the very most northern western tip of the Yukon. And getting from St. Catharines to that location is quite challenging with the amount of equipment that we have. Once we get there, it is difficult to get all of our equipment throughout the landscape because it's so remote. A lot of boat trips, very cold and windy boat trips, and a lot of hiking and camping. But that being said, it's a beautiful landscape that I'm really grateful to have the opportunity to go there and actually see it for myself.
So you mentioned your study area is Old Crow Flats in the Yukon. Why Old Crow Flats?
When I started my undergraduate research, I did so under the supervision of Dr. Kevin Turner, who is my supervisor for my master's project. And he has been conducting research in Old Crow since 2007. And that was a result of the International Polar Year Project. So it brought together local communities and researchers to collaborate on identifying key areas of interest for understanding changes that were occurring in the Arctic. So Kevin was a part of that group that got to meet with the Old Crow community. And since then, they identified areas of interest to study in Old Crow. And I was lucky enough to come onto that project in 2017.
So some of the research that you're doing is also informing some of the research that Dr. Turner's doing as well, in a roundabout sort of way?
Yeah, it's very much based off of his work. 10 years worth now of hydrology research that's been going on there. So they've been sampling the lakes and rivers every year. I think there's 52 sites in total around Old Crow where they get samples from, and they've been tracking the changes in these lakes for that time.
In Brock's geography department, we unfortunately don't offer a physical geography master's, which is why you've actually had to move to the earth science department to complete your master's. Mm-hmm. And although you're still doing that with Kevin Turner, who is obviously a professor of both departments, have you noticed any differences in experiences being a part of the earth science department as opposed to the geography department?
It would be kind of hard to have a real comparison, only because an undergraduate degree is significantly different from doing graduate work. I mean, I did take quite a few earth science courses during my undergrad, and there's a lot of parallels between the two departments, two programs. I currently TA a first year earth science course, and I see a lot of similarities to, you know, the first year physical geography course.
Mm-hmm.
But they do have their differences, and I would say it's hard to notice a massive change because my supervisor is in both departments.
Exactly, yeah.
So it's almost like we kind of went from the last day of the undergrad to the first day of the master's, and nothing changed.
Have you been getting to know other master's students in the earth science program now that you have an office in the department?
Yeah, definitely. I've definitely gotten to meet new people and see some pretty cool new projects, and it's been a really nice experience to see all that kind of variety that's going on at Brock.
Yeah, fantastic.
So I understand you're a little bit jet-lagged from a trip out to Seattle, I believe it was?
Yes.
And that was for the NASA Above Conference. And first off, what is NASA's Above?
Right. I'll try not to butcher saying this word, but it stands for the Arctic Boreal Vulnerability Experiment from NASA. And essentially, it is a large group of researchers that have come together to create a means for communication in order to standardize all of the research that's happening across the Arctic so that we can apply what we know from individual study sites and individual research groups and kind of apply that to the whole Arctic region in North America in general. And then the NASA part, NASA is running the Above program, and they're contributing by flying over all of the partnered study locations and providing a lot of multispectral imagery for us to use, which is really great.
So that sort of alleviates one headache of funding for, it's basically an in-kind donation from NASA for imagery for the study areas, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Specifically about the conference, were you there to deliver presentation, or were you there as poster presentation or speaking?
Mm-hmm. I had a poster that I brought that's a requirement for the annual meeting, but it's definitely more of a meeting than a typical conference would be. So there's a lot more focus groups and working group sessions where a lot more open discussion on field methodologies and different sort of research focuses that the entire program should have or individual groups should have. Whereas a typical conference, you know, most of the day is spent listening to 15-minute presentations with a question or two at the end. This one is definitely more of a full week of meeting with people.
So it's more of a meeting than it is a conference.
Yeah, I think it's titled the fourth annual Above Meeting, NASA right. Above Meeting. But there is still, at the end of every day, a two-hour poster session. And everyone that comes is required to have at least one poster from their representative project. So
I noticed on your CV that you're the creator of something called Geomatics. Can you tell us what this is about?
Right, that was, I believe it was the end of 2016, I had the idea to start a YouTube channel where I just documented how to use certain GIS software. And I felt that there was a lot of people in the geography community that were using software that I feel maybe not as useful in future years to come. So I thought it would be a good start to try to explain to people that you can use different techniques.
The GeoNiagara Radio Show is about the use of geospatial technologies and basically the promotion of geospatial technologies in geography and a lot of those cross-listed applications, so geospatial technologies in history, public health and things like that. Where do you see geospatial technologies going in terms of sort of the everyday uses of geography in the broader public?
I would say, to much of the chagrin of a lot of current undergrad students, I really do think that geocomputation, so the use of coding languages and open source software, is really where things are headed. And I believe that that's a good thing for people who are serious about geography and GIS applications, because you can really apply those to any field, any area of interest. That you can quite literally create your own customizable software for yourself.
I think that's one of the areas in geography that's sort of underrepresented, is sort of that cross between computer science and geography,
mm-hmm.
Both from a physical side of geography, but as well as the human side of geography.
What's the landscape and ecology like at Old Crow Flats?
It is a Arctic tundra location, and it's considered a lake-rich thermokarst region. So that means that there's a lot of water, a lot of lakes, a vast river network, and it all sits on top of permafrost,
wow.
So permanently frozen soil. And it is quite beautiful, especially in the summertime, spring and summer when I get to go. It is 24-hour sunlight when mm-hmm. we are there, so that is a pretty neat experience. There's a lot of shrub vegetation, a lot of wildlife.
Really?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Even in a tundra location.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
For sure. It's quite a privilege, I would say, to be able to go there and experience the landscape from the point of view that we get, because when we collect our samples from the lakes and the rivers, there's not enough time to hike everywhere. It's a huge landscape. It's 5,600 square kilometers. And so to get to these locations, we actually are flown around in a helicopter. So it's quite scenic there, mm-hmm. definitely.
Amazing.
And to put that in perspective, the Niagara region is about 1,900 square kilometers in total area. So it's roughly 2.5 times.
Mm-hmm.
Your study area is roughly 2.5 times the size of the Niagara region. Brent, in the list of programming languages that you have in your CV, there are some obvious ones that people would know, like JavaScript or CSS or HTML, and Python, maybe not so much, but you have in there R. Can you sort of give us in a nutshell what R is or what R does?
So for anyone that does know what Python is, R is similar to Python in that is a programming language that has a set of libraries that people have put together where you can use these libraries to perform a bunch of tasks, any kind of tasks that you would run on a regular, any other GIS kind of software, like I think QGIS or ArcGIS. You can do, I would say, anything that those programs can do, you could do in this coding language, plus much more, because it wasn't initially started for GIS. It was just an initial open source statistical programming language.
Yeah, I noticed you were using it for almost like a Word document.
Mm-hmm. I've actually stopped using Microsoft Word, which was very important to my entire undergraduate career, and I've started to write in R, including just my literature reviews and paragraph writing. It's not technically the R programming language that I'm writing in. It's a different programming language called Markdown that R allows you to write it around. So I can write some Markdown, which is more of a text editor language, and then I can tell it, well, now I want to do some computational work with the R language, and it will just do that in between all those spots.
And that text editor would be like an extension you would put into your R software, correct?
Yeah, it's the most common use for R for kind of any new users to use a program called RStudio. It's the user interface that people seem to be most accustomed to.
And so RStudio, for anybody who doesn't know, is the R program, and it actually is a little more user-friendly. So it
yes.
It kind of guides you through the process of R, whereas R is, in my experience, you have to already be familiar with computer language and computer coding to start in R. Whereas RStudio is a little more helpful in a way for someone who's just starting off with any of these programs.
Right. And I even think that computer coding and GIS kind of really go hand in hand for new users. Because when you write a sentence of code in a lot of different applications, so if it's not for GIS use, if it's for something completely different, you know, you run your code and it does something and maybe you get a value or some sort of output that, you know, numbers or something. But when you're using it for GIS applications, you know, you're producing maps and you're producing figures and you're producing visual information that's kind of that gives you that really nice feedback reward for completing that code.
Between when I started my undergrad and when I finished my postgraduate work, it just seems that now everything's light years ahead. Mm-hmm. And I just graduated like a short, you know, 8 years ago, 7 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of geographers or even people who are doing work in history or any social science for that matter, I think they're being a lot more encouraged to include coding in their work almost on a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm. The way I was introduced to R was by first taking it just a stats class, the mandatory statistics class. And I remember the first thought I had about it was, I hate this language. Mm-hmm. I hate this program. I never want to use it ever again in my life. And it's actually something that I don't think I could get through a single day of work without opening up R.
When I took stats, R wasn't even a thing. And so that's an indication of sort of where we are now with how embedded computer science is within all of the sort of social science disciplines.
Mm-hmm. So when I decided to start learning R and programming languages for GIS applications, it kind of came from the understanding that I come from a generation of what's called digital natives. So we grew up with technology. That's the classic joke about when we were really young, we would fix the VCR for our parents or our grandparents.
Oh, yeah.
But now I look at my son, who's 3 now, and he can navigate my phone better than I can.
Mm-hmm.
And their generation is looked at as the coding natives, because in elementary school now, at least in Ontario, there's at least an hour of mandatory coding class a week.
Really?
Yeah.
I had no idea we were doing that. That's actually really incredible and a much more tangible skill in a lot of ways to teach a language such as computers, which is universal amongst all computers in the world, probably, even though it's always ever-changing and developing.
Mm-hmm.
But to be able to understand this technology that we're using right in front of us, I think is so important. And where else is the world going to go? So why aren't we teaching our kids these things already?
Right, right. And I guess from my perspective as someone who's not in that group of coding natives, I look at it and I say, I better put enough time into learning this stuff because I only have X amount of years until they're going to be taking my job.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? So it's kind of a way for me to stay motivated to keep learning because I know that the people coming after me won't have the same learning curves that I had. So they'll be able to surpass me at a much faster rate.
You not only want to keep up with your colleagues, but now you're going to have to keep up with your son.
Right. And I was actually just at a first school meeting for my son, and they were telling us he is the class of 2036. And I think about that.
That's mind-boggling, right?
Yeah. But, I mean, it's coming sooner than you think, right?
Absolutely.
So people in high school these days are writing code that people spent entire careers on learning how to do, and it's pretty cool.
Are you aware of any resources for coding in, I guess, in a ballpark, I would say like coding for social sciences? Because I think context is, for geographers anyway, for me personally, it's the difference between having context to why I'm using this code or how I'm using this code. It's sort of the difference between being conversant in French and knowing what I'm looking at on a French menu. Like I know poulet mm-hmm. is chicken,
mm-hmm.
but I can't have a conversation with somebody in French.
Mm-hmm.
So are you aware of any resources sort of tailored to sort of geography mm-hmm. or history for that matter?
From the history side, I'm not as familiar with like specific textbooks or resources, but what I often tell people is if you're wanting to find anything that you think you need to do for a GIS kind of project, then use the internet. Use your search engine, whether it's Google or probably just Google. But that's where the information is on these programming languages, because the community around computer coding is quite large and quite helpful to each other. So there's a lot of forums and a lot of discussion groups online. And if you have a question on how to, you know, let's say just even plot a single map in a programming language, you just type into your search engine, plot map in, and then you name your programming language. And there will be pages of resources for you to go to.
Well, thanks for coming in, Brent. Really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule and you catching up on your sleep from being out west. Thank you for coming on the show, and we look forward to hearing more about your research in the coming months.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thinking of pursuing a career in the field of geography or tourism? The Department of Geography and Tourism Studies at Brock University offers 3 and 4 year bachelor's degrees and a geography graduate program, each with several study options. At Brock University, you'll get an excellent education with hands-on experience through internships, study abroad programs, co-op, labs, seminars, and more. Explore the world through your studies. Come to Brock and experience the Department of Geography and Tourism Studies today. Check us out at brocku.ca/geotour.
That was a great interview with Brent. Brent and I have gone through most of our undergrad together, so it was really nice to have him here in the studio talking about how he's furthered his research ever since.
Yeah, I was Brent's TA for the field course a few years back. I'm really intrigued by his use of our studio and a lot of the work that he's doing, if not all of the work that he's doing. I actually did a little bit of investigating of R recently, and it can seem pretty daunting, but I'm certain with, especially with what Brett was saying, sort of once you wrap your head around it a little bit, then you don't want to use anything else when you're doing your work. So I'm really encouraging other students, geographers, anybody for that matter, to explore the use of technologies that will help you do your work easier and more efficiently.
Yeah, absolutely. We all want a easier, more efficient way to get things done and get on to more fun things. So next up, we have Kristen Shaver and Alyssa Davies from Brock University, also in the Earth Science Department. Kristen and Alyssa have been working together for almost 2 years now and expected to finish up their thesis in August of 2018. Let's hear a little more about their research. Introducing Kristen and Alyssa. Today, I'm joined in the studio by Alyssa Davis and Kristen Shaver. Welcome to the studio, guys.
Hi. It's nice to be here.
Oh, it's nice to have you guys. It's a little bit of a cramped studio today, but we're going to make it work. Why don't you guys start by individually telling me a little bit about your background and how you ended up in the Earth Science program at Brock University?
Well, I'm Kristen. I was always interested in natural disasters and earth processes, and that's just kind of how I ended up here.
And I am actually from Trinidad and Tobago, and the reason I ended up here was also being really interested in geography for a long time. I got a scholarship to come to Brock University, was in the environmental geoscience program, and eventually things led to me doing my master's because we now have the same supervisor and we did the same after grad research opportunity, and now we're here.
they're very excited to be working with each other. You can tell here in the studio.
That's true.
So why don't we talk a little bit? Actually, Kristen, I want to know where you're from.
Oh, I'm from Bonneville, Ontario. Okay. It's a small town that's about an hour east of Toronto.
Okay, cool. So you guys came to Brock from Trinidad and Tobago, which is very unique. Was there a big gap in like the educational differences from coming from a country like that to Canada?
Well, up until what you guys would consider, I guess, grade 11, I was in the Trinidadian school system. But for grade 12, I actually was in the Canadian school system. And that's how I was able to learn about a lot of Canadian universities. So the transition was actually pretty easy, pretty simple. Coming into Canadian university, it wasn't that big of a transition, I wouldn't say.
So you had grade 12 experience with the Canadian school system.
That's true.
That's certainly going to help you progress into the next year and at least give you a head start, whereas we see a lot of international students at Brock, and I feel it's really hard to struggle through a straight-up university class coming in for your first time in education. So
yeah, I definitely see that being something that students might struggle with, and it probably was an easier transition for me versus other people, and I'm actually very grateful that I probably had that opportunity without even knowing it.
So you both are in a earth science master's program right now, correct?
Yes.
Awesome. So why don't we start a little bit about how you decided to get into your master's and what your research is on?
Well, we both got in with the same professor because we did a opportunity through Brock called Match of Minds.
Yeah.
And in that, you get to work under a professor, you get to work in their lab, you get to take part in some of their research. So that's how he kind of took us on to do our master's. That ended us in geochemistry.
That's true. When I did the research through Match of Minds, it was actually the summer right before I started my master's. So it was kind of a continuous like process for me. And that was pretty good because Kristen and I kind of both got this field experience the summer before we actually began our master's program. And we were able to get into that transition, I think, pretty easy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What would be like your individual research topics with your thesis? Or is it a joint master's because you're working under the same supervisor?
Our master's topics are very similar. We're both working with fluid inclusions in halite. So what that is, halite is rock salt. And as it forms, the edges form before the face of the crystal. And when it does, it traps some brine from which it precipitated.
And this just means that as the crystals, as the salt forms, so you could think about eating salt, for instance, as the salt forms, these tiny bubbles of gas get trapped within the salt itself, and we're looking at the gases trapped within those bubbles. And our salt is ancient salt deposits, so my salt is actually aged around 450 to 425 million years. And Kristen?
Mine is from the Carboniferous, so it's about aged around 330 million years ago.
How is this information useful to us? What can we do with this information once you projects wrap up?
So what I think is the most useful about this, besides the scientific aspect, which is actually looking at the Earth's oxygen and how it developed and looking at the development of life on Earth by looking at these minuscule fluid inclusions. But even today, we can look at the options of storing nuclear waste in salt deposits, looking at the association between salt and hydrocarbons. So it's kind of interesting to people on both the scientific and non-scientific background, I think, because there's an environmental aspect to gain from it.
So part of the scientific aspect is we're following the research of our co-supervisors, and they did it for earlier salt from the Neoproterozoic, and they were measuring the oxygen content. So they think it may have oxygen was more present earlier than previously expected.
So are we helping ourselves to learn more about our Earth and our past geological history with research such as yourselves?
I would say so, yes. And it's very interesting to learn because, of course, over the years, a lot of research has been done and it's been developed in one way and people would think of it in that way. But this is kind of a new approach and it's something that I think a lot of development is happening in, and it's interesting to not only us, but a lot of other researchers in other universities as well.
What would be some of the methodology and techniques you're using to complete your research?
The main test we ran was with a mass spectrometer, which measured the concentrations of atmospheric gases within the tiny little bubbles. To do that, we got to travel down to New Mexico Tech and work with one of our co-supervisors who actually developed the method with his PhD supervisor.
We also use other methods, so trace chemistry. So we look at the trace components that the salt may contain. So salt, if you don't know this, is composed of sodium and chloride ions. And sometimes by contamination, it might also contain magnesium or potassium. And that's kind of important when we're trying to determine where our salt was deposited. So if it was deposited in a marine condition or not, which is actually pretty important for us. We also have done microthermometry, which is something where we look at the temperature of the salt formation, and we were able to do that at Western University.
One of the issues we had when doing microthermometry was you have to freeze the halite for 5 weeks in advance and then transfer it frozen from Brock to Western, which is a bit of a drive. It's about 2 hours. So trying to keep it below zero for that long in a car is not that easy.
How did you manage to keep your samples cool that whole time?
We went to the dollar store and bought as many ice packs as we could fit in a cooler. Very simple.
It was, and when we were at Western, we actually got to use like liquid nitrogen in the equipment that we were using. So that actually helped to keep it cool while we transferred like these tiny, tiny 1 millimeter pieces of halite onto this microscope to actually look at the fluid inclusions and then to slowly warm it up, which is part of the process that we were doing. It was all such an interesting experience for us to learn.
And since we were taking something very cold and heating it up, we had a lot of condensation form within the microscope, which, if you don't know, halite is very soluble. If you put it in water, it dissolves. That caused us a lot of problems.
Yeah, that is so true. And it's something that we encountered a lot as well, just with all our methodologies, not being able to make like thin sections. So to look at our salt under the microscope, in order to make thin sections, you usually use a lot of water. And because we're dealing with salt, we can't, because it would just dissolve. It would just, if you put salt in water, it just dissolves. So it was something that we had to really find ways to work around.
Sounds like your subject area of like using salt for all this research is pretty difficult to work with. What, along with that, what were some of the biggest struggles you've had to overcome in your research thus far?
I think the thin sections was one of the biggest issues we had, because not only can you not use water, you also can't use heat, because if you use heat, it'll alter the fluid inclusions and make it look as if it weren't original material.
For your research, you got to go down to New Mexico, as we were just hearing. Tell us about that experience and all the fun things you get to do as a thesis student.
So the most memorable part about being a master's student are the trips we get to take. So one of them, we went down to New Mexico Tech, which is where we did a lot of our analyses. And just going down to New Mexico, it's such a different environment. It was all deserts. Me as a Trinidadian, I was driving on the opposite side of the road. So that was fun to do. And we got to see all these like cool things, mineral museums. We went to the top of a mountain.
We also did a road trip to Arizona to collect some samples from another professor who was retiring. And on the way, the professor we went with, we stopped at Meteor Crater. We saw some lava flows. We also drove down Salt River Canyon, which we set up a camera and got a beautiful video of. It was amazing.
So just being a master's student, a lot of the times when you have to get your samples or wherever you're actually doing your research, you get the opportunity to visit the location itself, which is such a great experience.
So how do you collect the samples you use for your research?
Well, my samples, I got to go to Nova Scotia to collect mine. There's a core library in Stellarton, I believe, and they have huge amounts, 5 buildings full of core from all over Nova Scotia. And I got to work with the people who actually work there full time, and they helped me collect all the samples, and they were very nice. And
unlike Kristen's, mine was actually pretty boring. It was only 2 hours away from St. Catharines, so I had to go down to London, Ontario. They have a salt and core library down there that they have all the cores because of hydrocarbon exploration. It's something that the government requires them to keep. And I got my salt from that library. What's interesting about getting my salt from there is that there were students from the University of Western that were working there part-time. And to me, if I had the opportunity as a student to work in such like a big core library and do that part-time, I think that would be pretty cool.
You guys have been working on your master's now for a couple semesters now. How long do you have to go before it's complete?
The goal is to finish by August 2018. It's set in stone. We're planning on doing it. We don't want to go any more time over than we have to. It's completely possible to finish a master's program in 2 years if you have no snags. If you have a snag, I see an extra semester, but our time is coming to an end pretty soon.
Yeah, so I'm also set to finish at the end of August, and I did have an issue with mine. I started a semester earlier, but because of the thin sections we were discussing earlier, that took some time to figure out. So I'm a little further behind, but still set to end in August.
Now for the million-dollar question. Where do you guys see yourself in 5 years?
The answer to this question is I will have a job and I will be successful. Kristen.
I'm also hoping to get some kind of employment. If that doesn't happen, maybe a PhD, who knows? Not saying no to any opportunity, just gonna figure it out as I go.
Yeah. If I can find something in my field, that would be great. But I'm also open to going on and doing my PhD research. If it's anything like my master's and I get to explore and kind of design my own project, I see that only being positive.
Yeah, so I'd just like to thank both of you, Kristen and Alyssa, for coming in today and joining me in the studio. It's been awesome to hear about your master's journey and a wonderful addition to the GeoNiagara radio show. We always love learning about geography, but we also love hearing about different disciplines such as earth science that are extremely closely tied. So thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having us. That was a really cool experience.
Thank you so much. And maybe if we're successful in the next 5 years, we'll come back.
Awesome, guys. Best of luck. Thank you.
Thanks.
Do you have any questions, comments, or show ideas? We encourage our listeners to connect with the GeoNiagara Radio Show. You can find us on Twitter at GeoNiagara. You can send us an email, geospatialniagara@gmail.com, or search GeoNiagara Radio Show on Facebook, where we post show notes from all the previous episodes and join the conversation. We look forward to hearing from you.
That was a fantastic interview with Kristen and Alyssa. They're very fun to talk to. You can tell they're best friends. It really comes through well off the air, I think. And I can't wait to see their research come through in August, and I wish them the best of luck with that.
So before we wrap up this episode, want to talk about the Olympics a little bit?
Yeah, it's been happening for past, I don't know, week and a half now, I'd say.
Yeah. Are you more of a Winter Olympics person or a Summer Olympics? Because I am definitely a Winter Olympics person.
Yeah, I think Winter Olympics are very exciting, especially being Canadian, and you have a lot more athletes, I think, to cheer for in the Winter Olympics. But I'm an all-around Olympics person. I just love watching all the countries compete against each other. I love that it's amateur sporting at its best. I love that it's global, it travels the world, it gets, you know, many, many countries included. I'm just an Olympics person.
My favorite events in the winter have to definitely be the short track speed skating.
Oh, yes.
And like it's like roller derby with blades.
Oh, my God, yeah. And it's so right up my alley.
And I just love watching that. And I like watching the the cross-country skiing and the biathlon.
Yeah,
stuff because
definitely
go Team Lithuania. we seem to be pretty good at the
that's where you guys excel,
the
right?
Skiing and the shooting.
Yes.
That's where we excel.
Back to your roots, I suppose. Yeah, and it's in South Korea this year. It's a 14-hour time difference from where we are in Canada. It's pretty crazy, but it's nice to have something on TV 24/7 and something to tune into all the time that's new and exciting, I'd say.
Yeah, I'm not sure where's the next Summer Olympics?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think it's in China, but I'm not totally sure, which is a little strange. Could be two back-to-back Asian countries, but at the same time, it's both Summer and Winter Olympics.
Yeah. Well, when we figure that out, we'll put that in the show notes and see if there's a website that we could... Oh, it's in Japan.
Japan. It is another Asian country.
It is in Japan.
Yes.
The reason I remember that is because my youngest son has been pestering me. Are we going to go to Japan to see the Olympics?
Oh, really?
Yes. So I'm not sure if it's actually in Tokyo or...
I would doubt it. They tend to not do them in big metropolises.
Near Tokyo. It's
yeah.
Sort of in that realm.
Yeah.
And one other thing that I sort of came across my desk recently is the... I don't know if you'd seen this, but they've been using LIDAR in the Guatemalan jungle to reveal Mayan cities.
Really?
Yes.
I was in Guatemala earlier this year in 2017.
And it's actually being hailed as a major breakthrough in Mayan archaeology. And they have identified the ruins of more than 60,000 houses, palaces, elevated highways, and other human-made features that have been hidden for centuries below the jungle. So for those who do not know, LIDAR stands for Light Detection and Ranging. And what it is a plane will fly over, and it'll shoot thousands of light pulses through the canopy of the jungle. And what ends up happening is that there's a very good differentiation between, say, the forest canopy and the ground surface and everything in between. And then what they can do is they can remove all of that surface vegetation, and what's left would be basically a bare surface of the floor of the jungle. And what that does, it can be used to delineate. If there's lots of straight lines, then... it's obviously pretty much a man-made feature. And
so are you saying that they're looking at this underground right now? As in these structures aren't necessarily revealed, but they know that they're there using this LIDAR technology?
Correct.
Really?
Yeah.
So do they have plans to dig deep and uncover structures?
I don't know whether they're going to physically, because that would entail destroying the jungle.
It would, yeah.
So I believe right now they're just going to be doing some research on sort of the orientation of all of these features with one another.
Just learning more just about the Mayans.
Learning more about their civilization structure. There were obviously a lot of just homes. You know, they might pick out one or two to do some more significant research on, but as for destroying huge swaths of jungle to do an excavation, I don't really think that's in the cards.
No, probably not.
I think there's plenty of research that they could do with the information that they're gathering. So
when I was in Guatemala, specifically in the city of Antigua, there was many tours that we could have driven to, but we only had less than a week and we didn't really want to spend too much time traveling too much. So in the town of Antigua, they actually had all sorts of old ruins that had just been sort of fenced off and not really done anything with. And you could just sort of see through the fence and look at them. And it turns out that most of them were actually Mayan ruins, but there are sometimes buildings built over top of them. And many, many years ago, there was earthquakes that just crumbled a lot of these structures. But because they were Mayan or of cultural significance many, many years ago, they've just left them standing as is from the remains of the earthquakes. So it was definitely kind of interesting to see when I was there.
One interesting note in that story, and we'll post the link to the story in the show notes. First of all, they're saying LIDAR to archaeology is what Hubble telescope is to astronomy. So doing a lot more work that's not so disturbing the ground.
Right.
Which is a good thing. But one thing that they note in the article, too, is that the surveyors revealed thousands of pits dug by modern-day looters.
Wow.
And in a quote from Marianne Hernandez, president of Pacunum Foundation, says many of these new sites are only new to us. They are not new to looters. Another concern that they have is environmental degradation. So they're saying Guatemala is losing more than 10% of its forests annually.
Mm.
And habitat loss has accelerated along its border with Mexico as trespassers burn and clear land for agriculture and human settlement. So I guess by identifying these areas through the use of LIDAR, they can better protect them when they can better protect them,
mm-hmm.
essentially. So that's really cool. So I'll post that in the show notes and it's a National Geographic article. It's really, really cool.
All right. I think that just about does it for today's show. Our next episode will air Wednesday, March 21st at 6 p.m. on 103.7 CFBU.
So for all of us at GeoNiagara Radio Show, I'm Darren.
And I'm RJ.
Have a great night.
Good night.
You have been listening to the GeoNiagara Radio Show, sponsored by the Department of Geography and Tourism Studies at Brock University.